You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
School of Humans.
Deep in Peru's cloud forests, a stream of fog weaves past tree trunks. Mist blankets the undergrowth, filtering the sunlight above and supplying moisture to the plants below. The result is one of the most diverse ecosystems on the planet. There are up to 3,000 species of orchids here, more than anywhere else in the world. The forest has a way of seducing people. And in 2002, the sirens lured James Michael Kovac to Peru. An orchid enthusiast, Kovac flew there in search of the Holy Grail, in search of flowers nobody could see anywhere else. And one day, as he walked past a roadside flower vendor, his heart nearly jumped out of his chest. It was a lady slipper, a pinkish-purple orchid with giant petals unfurling like the wings of a butterfly. Kovac was mesmerized. He began haggling with the shopkeeper, but they refused to budge. The owners knew they had something special, so Kovac paid the asking price, $3.60. A week later, Kovac had printed his boarding pass home. He slipped the orchid into a cardboard tube and boarded a flight to the United States. When he landed in Miami, customs officers failed to stop him. So Kovac made his way to Sarasota, to the Marie Selby Botanical Gardens, home to one of the most diverse orchid collections in the world. Kovac brought the specimen in and watched the reactions. According to journalist Craig Pittman's book, The Scent of Scandal, the flower sparked a simultaneous wave of eye widening and mouth opening. Nobody bothered to ask if he had acquired it legally. Shortly after, Selby published a scientific description of the new orchid. They named it Phragmopedium kovacii. Then phone lines at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service started to buzz. It was Peru, an American botanical garden they claimed was saying it, quote, discovered an orchid that had been clearly smuggled out of Peru. Soon, armed agents were knocking on Kovac's door. They confiscated his papers and more than 300 plants. Indictments streamed in. The gardens were fined for violating the Endangered Species Act. The garden's orchid expert placed under house arrest. As part of the punishment, the garden had to buy a full-page ad in a trade magazine apologizing, a subtle message to other institutions that they should learn from Selby's mistakes. That was the dirty secret in botany. This type of low-key smuggling was par for the course. In fact, when activists tried to change the name of Phragmopedium kovacii arguing it was wrong to name the plant after a person who poached it. Scientific authorities shrugged and did nothing. This, they said, was too high a standard. If botany reclassified every plant name for smugglers, poachers, and thieves, the entire field would suffer, quote, major nomenclature instability. In layman's terms, it would throw the entire scientific field into turmoil. On this podcast, we've explored the crimes of obsessed hobbyists, of organized gangs, and even corrupt governments. But what about the elephant in the room? What about when the places entrusted to conserve plant life are committing the crimes? In this last episode, when the worlds of policy and piracy collide, I'm Summer Rain Oaks from School of Humans and iHeart Podcasts. This is Bad Seeds. In the early 2000s, the Selby scandal would divide orchid collectors. Some complained that this was government overreach. Others wailed that it was about time. Rich Western institutions had been taking credit for, quote-unquote, discovering plants that natives knew about for ages. But the fight went far beyond claims of who got there first. For many, the problem was the profit motive. Kovac told investigators he planned to artificially propagate the smuggled flower en masse, and those are his words. He didn't express any intention to share future profits with the people in Peru who had actually discovered and were actively protecting the plant. In botany, this kind of behavior, smuggling a plant and then getting rich off its mass production, conjures a painful past, especially in South America.
You start to hear them call Henry Wickham the pirate of the Amazon and the destroyer of worlds.
That's Joe Jackson. He's a writer.
I'm the author of The Thief at the End of the World.
And he's an expert on one of South America's most reviled villains, an Englishman by the name of Henry Wickham.
He was born in 1846, had a comfortable middle-class upbringing until his father died in one of the cholera epidemics in 1855 or 1856. And, you know, back then you didn't have pensions and his mother had three kids. He had a dream and drastic descent in class and he had a spirit of adventure and he had a talent for art. And at that time, if you were an adventurous boy in the British Empire, you went out to the wild places and you explored and you wrote a book about your travels, and Henry thought he was ready made for that. The explorers were the astronauts of that generation, and Henry wanted to do that.
So Henry, desperate for both money and adventure, set out into the world, spending his 20s exploring places like Belize and Nicaragua, hoping the jungles would give him material for books and maybe even change his family's fortunes.
He wasn't driven by science. He was driven by ambition. I mean, he kind of wanted to come back up in the world from what he had lost. He was ambitious.
Sometimes to his detriment, Henry was a thoughtless explorer. Consider the time he brought his wife, Violet, to the islands near Papua New Guinea.
There were still cannibal tribes in some of the islands around there. And Henry was pretty impulsive. And some of the natives had stolen a couple of his canoes, and Henry got real mad, and he took some of his workers, and he went paddling after them and left Violet on that island for, I don't know, like 10, 12 days, something like that, by herself. And she knew there were cannibals around.
Turns out that leaving your wife alone on an island inhabited by cannibals, not a great recipe for a happy marriage. Violet ended up being okay, but their union, not so much. Henry's absent-mindedness aside, his travels helped him become something of an expert on rubber. And this was the 1870s. Rubber was big. Railroads, telegraph companies, bicycle manufacturers, hose and gasket makers, all of them were starving for the stretchy stuff.
Rubber was an essential component. Everything was steam-driven, so you had giant turbines, you had these giant pistons, You had looms, steam-powered looms, and you had the British Empire's navy. And with all of these moving parts, you needed oil, but you also needed rubber to cushion the blow.
Problem was, there was only one place to get rubber: the Amazon Basin. About 90% of the world's latex came out of Brazil, and that demand, derived from the para tree, Hevea brasiliensis, was fueling a boom of wealth. Entrepreneurs flooded Brazil, laying thousands of miles of railroad track and erecting resplendent buildings sculpted from the finest European marble. The British wanted in on it.
They needed to find some way of getting rubber from the forests of Brazil to the British Empire's own possessions.
And that's when they set eyes on Henry Wickham.
And the director of Kew Gardens, a guy by the name of William Hooker, wrote to the council and said, "Find me that guy. He knows something about rubber." So Henry did not go to the Amazon thinking he was going to be a secret agent for Kew, but in a way, he became a secret agent for Kew because Hooker wrote him and said, "Would you agree to be our agent and bring as much rubber back as you possibly could?"
Henry agreed. In 1876, he paddled down the Amazon River and moored his boat near the town of Boim by a grove of para trees. There, Henry enlisted a group of locals to help him collect more than 70,000 rubber seeds, wrapping them in banana leaves. When it came time to leave the country, Brazilian officials asked Henry if he had any seeds on him. He lied and said he had some, but that they were academic specimens.
He said, "I've got some rubber seeds," and he paid the tariff on, about 10 or 12 seeds. I forget the exact number, but it was very low.
It was an undercount of, say, 69,990.
He sailed off and he brought his seeds to Kew Gardens, and 12% of them survived.
British scientists grew the seeds and sent the surviving specimens to the British Empire's colonies.
They eventually transferred them to vast plantations around Singapore and Malaysia, and that became the British Rubber Empire.
The British Empire's rubber plantations, all grown from Henry's seeds, would utterly destroy the trade in Brazil.
And it broke the back of Brazil's rubber empire in 1 year, which is pretty dramatic.
In the 1870s, the South American country controlled the world's rubber production. By the 1920s, it had all slipped away. The dramatic boom and bust killed Brazil's economic momentum, with effects that are still felt today. In Britain, Henry would be knighted, but Brazilians would give him a much different title.
He was the devil incarnate. They hated him down in Brazil. They thought he had raped the nation.
He'd be called the Príncipe dos Ladrões, the Prince of Thieves. Today, botanists have another name for him, biopirate.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up! and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and everybody. It's spring, and with the weather changing and so many great things coming up like Mother's Day and the wind-down tour, I definitely need a fresh spring wardrobe for every occasion. This spring, I'm looking for that perfect flowy spring dress for Mother's Day, as well as replacing my everyday basics. That's what I love about JCPenney. They have so many stylish and comfortable options that I always find just what I'm looking for there. Spring is a feel-good season and comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. The fashion at JCPenney is the same way. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with styles that gets you, something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes, and Stafford and Mutual Weave for him, style and comfort for all, even big and tall. Plus even more for the whole family like Levi's and Exertion. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
Henry Wickham's theft of those seeds would sap incalculable economic potential from Brazil while enriching the leaders of British industry. But what did his actions do for him?
The British Empire kind of patted him on the back and paid him the equivalent of about $700 and said, go on your way, buddy. And he felt cheated pretty much for the rest of his life. And what he did for the rest of his life was basically try to discover this next great wonder plant. And he never really did. He never found anything that was as, quote, miraculous as the rubber tree. I don't know. It's kind of like some mythological character that kind of wanders the world trying to replicate his early success.
If you search the annals of botany, if you look at the names of great plant explorers, you discover more and more people like Henry Wickham, people who today we'd call poachers, traffickers, and thieves, or as experts now call them, biopirates. It's something of a theme. In 2014, the journalist Sam Knight, writing for The Guardian, put it this way, quote, "One big problem with plant crime is that it is so difficult to distinguish from the act of botany itself." For decades, biopiracy was not the exception, but the rule. Kew Gardens paid Henry Wickham £700 to steal, mislabel, and smuggle those rubber seeds out of Brazil. The British East India Company asked the Scotsman Robert Fortune to sneak into forbidden China and steal the country's tea-making secrets. The list goes on and on. In a way, the study of botany was just an extension of empire, or in other words, exploitation. And most of these early-day biopirates felt little remorse. They had no problem stealing from or talking down to native populations. In the words of one 19th century botanist,
"The Spanish Americans have accomplished nothing in the development of the knowledge of their own floras and vegetable products. The Anglo-Saxon blood must originate and direct all exploitation and development."
This, of course, couldn't have been further from the truth. Take Cinchona officinalis, a leafy green shrub with starburst blooms that grows across the Andean forest. For centuries, Peruvians and Bolivians had used cinchona bark to stop fever. They were on to something. The plant contains quinine, an anti-malarial. Centuries after that discovery, a British alpaca farmer named Charles Ledger caught wind of the bark's medicinal properties. In the 1860s, he traveled through Peru and Bolivia. And with the help of his servant, a native named Manuel Incra Mamani, he stole seeds, smuggled them to Europe, and sold them to the Dutch. The production and study of quinine soon exploded. It would save millions of lives. And that is where the ethics of biopiracy gets sort of hairy.
It's a real gray area in a lot of ways. There's always two sides to this biopiracy thing. I mean, it's a sovereign nation. Seems like it should have a right to the things that are found within its borders. But then what the British Empire used when they were taking the cinchona tree for quinine, they said, well, look, this is for the greater good of mankind. And that's something that still is going on.
Regardless of where you land on the issue of quinine, this long history of biopiracy left many nations, especially those in South America and Africa, feeling cheated. And it wouldn't be addressed by the international stage until the early 1990s.
In Rio de Janeiro, you had the 1992 Earth Summit, the first summit that basically came up with international regulations against biopiracy.
That year, an international treaty was signed, the rules for which are pretty simple. If a country is home to a genetic resource, for instance, a rare or unique plant like rubber, then that country is entitled to benefit financially from any profits when the plant is sold elsewhere. It's essentially a thank you for keeping and protecting the plant over the past few centuries. The same goes for traditional knowledge. If a pharmaceutical company learns about a plant's medicinal benefits thanks to indigenous knowledge, then locals deserve some financial compensation when the profits roll in. In other words, it's about giving credit where credit is due. Despite these efforts, biopiracy remains what Jackson calls a rancorous issue, especially as corporations get bigger and bigger.
You still have that kind of sovereign rights versus the greater good, that kind of push and pull that is part of the argument, that's part of the exchange. People don't really believe in empire right now. Government empires aren't so big, but I mean, private empires are a big deal.
In the U.S., corporations can patent a plant. New breeds can be protected by intellectual property law. And this has gotten some folks in trouble. In 1995, the U.S. Patent Office granted scientists a patent for turmeric, also known as curcuma longa, because it could be used for wound healing. Of course, over in India, locals had known this for centuries, if not thousands of years. A couple years later, a Texas company tried to patent basmati rice, a decision that, to put it lightly, made a lot of farmers in India very angry. And the treaty itself, even though it's prevented a lot of exploitation and theft, has its downsides, because as it's gotten harder to export and study some plants, they've only gotten rarer and more endangered.
By the time I wrote the book and talked to some just botanists and entomologists who would go down to the Amazon and study these things, they said, you go down there and you're the villain. You don't know whether or not you're going to be called a biopirate, even after you've jumped through all the hoops and paid all of the fees at the airport. They might decide that you're trying to steal from them and they'll sequester you for a long time. All of you or specimens will die.
The ability to patent plants in the U.S. has also made it a huge target of foreign biopirates. It's 2011, and a field manager working at DuPont Pioneer is peering across a cornfield when he notices an Asian man crouched over a row of maize, sifting through the dirt. Now, this isn't just any old cornfield. This is a grower field, a place where agricultural companies test new strains of veggies, ones that could be more resistant to disease and famine. In other words, exactly the kind of plants a foreign nation might want to steal and replicate. The manager drives over to the visitor and confronts him. The man named Mo looks startled. He explains he worked for a university, but he doesn't go into any more detail. Instead, he quickly gets in his car and speeds away. The field manager notifies the FBI. Turns out, the FBI is already on Mo's tail. Mo Hailong has been sneaking through the cornfields of Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa with a crew of accomplices, stealing ears of corn, rooting up seedlings. The FBI discovers that Mo works for a Chinese agricultural company, and he's been targeting cornfields owned by American corporations. His goal? to unlock the trade secrets buried in the DNA of various new GMO corn. If he can steal the seeds, his employer can reverse engineer the plant to skip years of expensive biotech research required to create new strains. Mo and his accomplices would later be caught trying to ship 250 pounds of stolen corn seed to China, hiding hundreds of small samples in envelopes of microwave popcorn. The trade secrets hidden in those seeds were worth at least $30 million. After police caught up with him, Mo would be sentenced to 3 years in prison. A pretty light sentence for a biopirate, all things considered. Because remember that story about Charles Ledger, the guy whose sticky fingers helped launch the world quinine biz? You may recall he had help from a native, a guy named Manuel Inkra Mamani. Well, in Europe, Ledger was celebrated as a hero. But Inkra Mamani? Back home, locals soon learned what he had done. And he'd be arrested, beaten, tortured, and then killed. The difference between a smuggler and a saint, between a backstabber and a lifesaver, may merely depend on whether you live in the nation that was pilfered or the one that profited. But where there are people willing to kill for a plant, there are others who are willing to die for one. Their story when we return.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and everybody. It's spring, and with the weather changing and so many great things coming up like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, I definitely need a fresh spring wardrobe for every occasion. This spring, I'm looking for that perfect flowy spring dress for Mother's Day, as well as replacing my everyday basics. That's what I love about JCPenney. They have so many stylish and comfortable options that I always find just what I'm looking for there. Spring is a feel-good season and comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. The fashion at JCPenney is the same way. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with styles that gets you, something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes, and Stafford and Mutual Weave for him, style and comfort for all, even big and tall. Plus even more for the whole family like Levi's and Exertion. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Leningrad, 1943. Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union with a plan. First, they would surround Leningrad. Then they'd cut off the city's supply routes. And then finally, they'd starve the population into submission. The goal, according to a high-level memo, was to, quote, wipe Leningrad from the face of the earth. For months, Germans dropped bombs onto Leningrad's hospitals and homes. The Luftwaffe zeroed in on the food depots and markets. Meanwhile, Axis troops looted the city's famously ornate palaces, transforming them into smoldering heaps of ash. Leningrad became a tomb. Michael Walzer, a political theorist, claims, quote, more civilians died in the siege of Leningrad than in the modernist infernos of Hamburg, Dresden, Tokyo, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki taken together. But the Red Army punched back. Snipers lurked in the rubble, hid in the bell towers, and burrowed under bodies. A chorus of anti-aircraft weapons boomed day and night. Millions of ordinary people who did not or could not evacuate stretched their bread rations by substituting flour with sawdust. And in the center of town, a team of botanists made a decision that would change the course of world history forever. In 1943, Leningrad housed one of the world's largest seed banks. Established 2 decades earlier, the institute was at the forefront of a new type of botany. Not as a haven for biopirates or greedy monarchs, but a new botany for the good of the world. In Leningrad, scientists used a vast collection of seeds to study plant immunity, pathology, and cultivation. It was a library designed to preserve and protect the plant world's genetic story, a repository and intensive care unit for some of the planet's rarest and most endangered species. As the neighborhood around the institute crumbled, dozens of botanists working inside risked their lives to keep those seeds safe. But bombs and mortar fire were the least of the botanists' worries. Their greatest enemy was their own hunger. To preserve the seeds, the botanists had to keep the collections warm. With electricity destroyed and the brutal Russian winter barreling in, the scientists scoured the charred rubble of their beloved city, burning any scraps to keep the collection alive. Then the ice swept in. With the cold came mass starvation. Up to 100,000 people began dying every month. Even the rats began to show their rib cages. Inside the seed bank, the botanists, grappling with their own hunger, faced an unrelenting temptation. They had access to rice, wheat, peas, oats, corn, the workhorses of agriculture. And yet each scientist, despite growing increasingly hungry, refused to tap into the collection to save themselves. One by one, the botanists starved. According to the Washington Post, the first was Alexander Stutkin, a peanut expert. He collapsed at his desk. Then it was the Institute's rice specialist, and then another, and another. Eating the seeds could have saved their lives. But each scientist had made a choice. They refused to grow or eat the seeds because doing so would have destroyed the future they had worked toward. The siege of Leningrad lasted 872 days. Over that time, at least 9 botanists starved to death. But the seeds survived. Years later, those same seeds would be crossbred to produce crops used around the world today. You and I have definitely eaten food descended from those Leningrad seeds. In a world of biopirates, these botanists were something different. What journalist Boyce Rensberger called the first martyrs for biodiversity. And that's where we want to end this podcast. By focusing not on the thieves, the crooks, and the corruption, we want to end by shining a light on the people making huge sacrifices right now to save us all. In the 1940s, the Leningrad Seed Bank was a novelty. But today, there are approximately 1,700 seed banks across the globe.
My name's Eleanor Braman, and I work at the Millennium Seed Bank at the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew.
The Millennium Seed Bank program is the largest conservation resource in the world. If there's any place to find hope in the future, it's here.
Since 2000, we've worked with 97 different countries and territories to help conserve their native flora. It sounds deceptively simple. You just say, well, you just go out and you collect some seeds and then we dry them and freeze them.
Of course, it's a little more involved than that. The Millennium Seed Bank is the kind of place that would make a doomsday prepper drool.
The vault underground is actually within 0.5 meter thick reinforced concrete, so we're near an international airport. The idea was it could withstand a plane going down. We've also got radiation detection, which would cut off air supply to the vault if radiation was detected. And we have a flood protection mechanism, and we have backup generators, and we have some solar power.
And protected in these underground vaults are seeds. Lots and lots of seeds.
So we've currently got 6 walk-in cold rooms that are active. 4 of those are full, and we've got space for 4 more. We've currently got 40,000 species held in our vault.
40,000 species, or at the moment, around 15% of the world's plants, all being saved for the future and emergencies.
We are a real bank in that sense. We save things, we hold it for a rainy day, but you can withdraw seeds at any time.
And Millennium is not alone. Many countries have their own networks of seed banks. In the United States, there's the National Plant Germplasm System, full of cryopreserved seeds in Fort Collins, Colorado. Cherokee Nation has its own seed vault. And at the Smithsonian, scientists are currently banking the genetics of 200-plus orchids native to the U.S., more than half of which are endangered.
It goes back to the fundamental that all life's dependent on plants. The majority of our ecosystems are made up of wild plants, and these are the things that are providing us with the oxygen that we breathe and preventing floods and providing all these amazing services within the landscape. We tend to focus on things that are threatened in the wild, things that are rare, so they're likely to become threatened, and also useful plants, and that's in the broadest sense. You know, it could be useful for food, for medicine, for fiber, for cultural reasons, whatever it is.
Focusing on plants that are threatened carries a certain feel-good message. But it's not like you could bring a species back from the dead, like back from extinction, right? Wrong. In the 1990s, there was only one Cylindrocline lorentzi alive in the wild. The small tree, native to the island nation of Mauritius, was saved from oblivion when scientists successfully extracted and grew cells from dead Cylindrocline seeds. More recently, researchers in Israel were able to nurture a date palm called Phoenix dactylifera from 2,000-year-old seeds. That tree now bears the same fruit that biblical figures may have eaten. And impressively, in 2012, scientists discovered a seed of a flowering Siberian plant, which had been buried by an Ice Age squirrel 32,000 years ago. And they successfully revived it. And you know, that spells hope for the plants plagued with poaching or overexploitation, because it's here, in places like this, that solutions are emerging.
We're involved in a project in South Africa because the illegal trade in succulent plants there is kind of at a crisis point. They've seized something like 700,000 individual plants at the borders to date. And some of those plants can be tens to hundreds of years old. So, you know, the impact that that's having on these populations is pushing them towards extinction. So our partners in South Africa have recently developed a nursery for growing on succulent plants and for training their staff in how to propagate them and how to restore them to the wild. And we've got a really interesting program that's just starting to see if you can use stable isotopes within the plants as a signature for where they came from. So then could you say whether something's been illegally collected or was from a reputable nursery? So can we help to stop this illegal trade in that way?
Maybe in the not too distant future, buying plants will be more secure and transparent. You'll be walking through the store and be assured that the plant you're buying didn't come from a bad seed.
So we're going to walk just a little bit further down this hiking trail.
We wanted to end here, in Tennessee.
So as we get out here and take a walk, you'll see gravel right at the surface. So very, very little soil, very rocky, harsh environment for plants to grow in.
David Lincecum, manager of the Natural Heritage Program for the state of Tennessee, is showing our producer Gabby around the state's Cedar Glades to witness a little miracle.
Today we are here at Couchville Cedar Glade State Natural Area in Davidson County, Tennessee. Today we're going to look for the Tennessee purple coneflower, Echinacea tennesseensis. It is a globally rare species and a state rare species.
The Tennessee coneflower, Echinacea tennesseensis, is a gorgeous bloom. It kind of resembles a spindly purple daisy. It attracts important pollinators like bees and butterflies. It's also rare. It only exists right here in Tennessee.
The plants that occur here, many of them occur nowhere else in the world, including our Tennessee purple coneflower. It's surprising when you walk this hiking trail, the coneflower is scattered throughout, and it's so common here that probably no one really thinks about it being globally rare. In about a 15-mile range here, and there's only 5 wild populations, and that's in the entire world. And it's all right here, primarily in Davidson County, Wilson County, and Rutherford County in Tennessee.
The coneflower thrives in this unique environment, where shallow soil is layered atop limestone croppings. But back in the day, its survival was at risk. In the 1970s, it became just the second plant to be added to the U.S. Endangered Species List. But when state and federal entities realized it was at risk of disappearing, they jumped into action to conserve it.
So it's the two-pronged approach of protecting the habitat and then working with conservation horticulture to collect seeds, propagate plants, and reestablish colonies that has really proven to be successful for this species.
Workers acquired land to protect the environment. They enlisted botanic gardens to propagate the coneflower. They sent specimens to seed banks for preservation. Up until 2011, the government was spending around $30,000 a year to keep the flower on life support. And it worked. All of that effort helped revive a plant staring down extinction. Similar efforts have worked with other plants you've heard about in this podcast. The St. Helena ebony is bouncing back. The cacti that you heard about in episode 1, the ones found in a man's apartment in Italy, they're back home in Chile too. For the coneflower, botanical gardens and seed banks saved the day. They propagated the plants, providing an alternate source for obsessed buyers known as Echinacea rockytop, helping reduce collection pressures on wild populations. Seeds became widely available across the country, feeding the demands of gardeners. And with the Cedar Glades protected, the government was able to reintroduce the flower into the wild. In 2011, the Tennessee coneflower was removed from the endangered species list.
The Tennessee coneflower was a big deal because it was one of the first plant species ever listed on the Endangered Species Act, and it took 32 years to reach that recovery state. It's quite an achievement for myself. That was one of the first species I was really actively in working with, and reaching recovery, I mean, that's what our job is to get these species off the list, and so being able to actually do that and accomplish it was very rewarding. It really took a small army of folks to make it happen.
It really does take an army. And now, you're a part of it. Because the first step is awareness. But if you're still wondering, where do I go from here? How do I help stop this? I have a few ideas. First, know where your plants come from, especially if you're like buying wood or something like that. If the person or place you're buying from can't tell you anything about the plant's source, then get it somewhere else. If you're dealing with foreign or endangered species, always ask for a phytosanitary certificate. If they don't have one, look elsewhere. And please don't buy non-commercial plants from places that do not have nursery certificates. Many can be illegal or poached. Now, if you must, always ask the seller to show their nursery certificate, permit, or phytosanitary certificate if need be. Support your local botanical garden. Not only are they wonderful places to visit, but your money goes straight to the conservation and protection of species. And you could give to groups like the Environmental Investigation Agency, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, or Cactus and Succulent Plants Specialist Group. The work they do matters. And please, if you're in the U.S. and witness the poaching or trafficking of plants, or have any evidence of any other wildlife crime, report it to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Their tip line is 1-844-397-8477. Again, that is 1-844-397-8477. I'm Summer Rain Oaks. That's it for Bad Seeds. Thank you for listening and for building a future for some good to grow. Bad Seeds is a production of School of Humans and iHeart Podcasts. I'm your host, Summer Rain Oaks. Lucas Riley is our writer. Gabby Watts is our producer. And Amelia Brock is our senior producer. Fact-checking is by Savannah Hugely and Zoe Farrow. Original music is by Claire Campbell. Sound design and score is by Jesse Neiswanger. Development was by Brian Lavin and Jacob Selzer. Special thanks to our voice actor, Christopher Goldie. Executive producers are Brian Lavin, Elsie Crowley, Brandon Barr, Virginia Prescott, and Jacob Selzer.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX this Friday and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.